Don't know why that's... Are you seeing your bio?
No.
Okay, it's gone. Okay, so we're ready to go at 1:28. Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Michelle Lute. Michelle is a conservation scientist and advocate with 15 years' experience in biodiversity conservation on public and private lands around the globe. She dedicates her professional life promoting human-wildlife coexistence through effective public engagement, equitable participatory processes, and evidence-based decision-making. She holds a PhD in wildlife management from Michigan State University, an MS in animal behavior and ecology from the University of Notre Dame, and a BS in geography and environmental science from Valparaiso University. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Thanks so much. Happy to be here.
So what's going on with wolves in Idaho?
Well, that's a great question, and it's a sad answer. Wolves in Idaho, like Montana and a lot of other places, are under attack by politicians and their wolf-hating constituents, essentially. Idaho has just passed, and the governor has just signed legislation to reduce the population by 90%, trying to get it down to 150 wolves in the state. And Montana has also passed similar kinds of legislation to make killing of wolves very easy. Really what we're seeing is a return to bounty systems with people paying up to $1,500 for a dead wolf and incentivizing trappers and killers to kill wolves by this legislation and these payments for killing. They're allowing wolves to be trapped, snared with leg hold or neck hold snares. They're allowing people to run down wolves with snow machines and four-wheelers. And so really it's no holds barred. The whole lethal arsenal is being pulled out to attack wolves, not just in Idaho, but in Montana and also in the Great Lakes and states like Wisconsin. So, we're seeing this return to a war on wolves that, has a really long history. If you've ever read anything about wolves, you know, people will usually explain that, you know, Manifest Destiny and white settlement across North America wiped out wolves pretty effectively. And the use of poisons and traps were integral. So they're very indiscriminate, but you can put them out in the landscape. You can leave them. It doesn't require much work. You can leave these devices out and kill wolves and lots of other wildlife that get trapped in them, and sometimes that's endangered species. But we've had this long history of this war using the most indiscriminate, cruel, and barbaric tools. And, you know, the advent of the Endangered Species Act and modern conservation biology has seen a return of wolves to the historic landscapes that they used to be in and that they're integral to. And we thought, you know, as conservationists and as citizens of the world, that we were moving in a good direction and helping wolves recover across their historic range. And now we're seeing all of that success, all of that effort, dedication for decades to bring wolves back, to reintroduce them to places like Yellowstone and Idaho and other places. All of that money, taxpayer dollars used to fund these programs with the federal government and states helping bring wolves back. We're now seeing really the loss of all of that progress potentially with the legislation happening in Idaho and Montana. And it's really, really alarming to think that in 2021, this is the state of wolf management or conservation. And it's really scary.
So there are a bunch of directions we could go with that. And one of them I want to ask is you said the word bounty, and two things. One is, can you talk a little bit about the history of wolf bounties? And second, so just to be clear, the law that was just signed doesn't make it so somebody can pay $1,500 for a license to kill a wolf, but they're paid for a wolf? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, so the Idaho Wolf Control Board, the specific legislation in Idaho, is proposing a huge addition of funding to the Idaho Wolf Control Board. They already get something like I don't know exactly offhand if it's 140,000. And I think they're upping their funding to $400,000. And that money would be spent to hire contract killers, basically. So to hire, people, on contract to kill wolves.
So, and this doesn't make it any better, but so it's not a specific bounty like they used to do, but instead it's, they'll be paying somebody whose job it is to go kill wolves.
Yes. In the Idaho legislation specifically, yes. There's other instances where we're seeing posts about paying people $1,500, to trap and kill wolves. And I believe those have been coming from Montana. But yes, the Idaho legislation is contractual, wolf killing through the Idaho Wolf Control Board.
Okay. So something I've mentioned in previous interviews that blows me away is that I interviewed someone about educating people in India about the danger of king cobra bites. And there are tens of thousands of people literally die in India every year from these snake bites, tens of thousands. And one of the questions I asked him was, so when you're working with people to try to educate them, do you have to deal with a lot of snake hatred? And he said, no, it's not that at all. They love the snakes. It's just we have to teach them to wear Wellingtons, to wear rubber boots when they walk through an irrigated field, mm-hmm. so they don't accidentally step on a snake. It's purely technical. Mm-hmm. And when I interviewed him, I contrasted that with the wolf hatred in the United States. And again, tens of thousands of people die in India from snake bites, and they don't hate the snakes.
Mm-hmm.
And do you don't have to, but do you want to talk about wolf hatred a little bit, or do you want to, or would you rather not?
Yeah, we can talk about that.
Because it blows me away. Having lived in Nevada and Idaho, it blows me away how much some subsectors of the population hate wolves. I never understood it. Even though I talked to them and had some of them as friends, I still didn't get it.
Right. Yeah. It's I appreciate the example from India. Just to add another one, I have a friend who studies tigers in Nepal, and tigers do sometimes, kill people. And, the response is not typically, one of hatred and let's, tear down the forest to find this tiger and kill it. And some of that might be cultural and religious. And, culture and religion can have such an impact on the way we place ourselves in nature. Judeo-Christian traditions have been arguably blamed for placing man above nature. And some people have argued, there's a lot of room for caring about nature. We see in the Old and New Testament. So I don't want to vilify any particular religion. And I think, that's left to scholars to kind of piece apart, whether or not religion is part of it. But we definitely see Hindu and Buddhist cultures, being much more tolerant of wildlife in the local context. And of course, as a scientist, we have to say there's multiple different factors at play here. But I do think, that really has to be one of them. A culture of domination, has been one for America for a really long time. As I already mentioned, Manifest Destiny and, this is our continent to take over, ignoring that there were other people, human and non-human persons that call this place home and that we should be sharing this globe with. And we're not very good at it, in the U.S. and in other places. So I think culture, an assumption that wildlife exists for our use, is way too dominant in our particular culture, in North America especially. Assuming that if an animal is inconvenient to you, you can get rid of it, dispose of it in any manner that is most convenient to you. And that's where we see trapping and snaring and poisons coming up as a tool. So this consumptive use, perspective, I think is really problematic. And I think, recognizing, like I think it was just in the UK, they passed a law recognizing the, rights of certain animals. You know, I was just meant to read this. It's a Guardian article. Animals to be formally recognized as sentient beings in UK law. So here's some hope that we can start recognizing the personhood, the intrinsic value of other animals to exist beyond our use to them. And that's something that I've, some of my scholarship, some of my research has done, is to ask people, you know, do you attribute intrinsic value to wolves or other wildlife? An intrinsic value is that value or right to exist beyond your use to anybody else. And so I ask lots of people in the Great Lakes, in across America, you know, do you attribute intrinsic value to wolves? And people predominantly say yes. And then the sticking point is to identify, okay, what uses or needs trump the intrinsic value of wolves? So if they're threatening your livestock in an immediate situation, does protecting your livestock trump the intrinsic value of wolves? Some people are going to say yes. Some people are going to say no. And so that gets at the heart of why different people conflict over wolf management. So I'm starting to take it in a different direction. We can talk more about that. But in terms of wolf hatred, what we're seeing happening in Idaho, Montana, I mean, I don't think these people, if you ask them, some of them might say, yeah, wolves have some intrinsic value, but I should be able to still kill them by any means that I want because there should really only be, you know, 150 wolves in the state or 300 across the Northern Rocky ecosystem. And that is something that, you know, I think that gets into the ecological role that wolves play. So I think for these people who hate wolves, whether or not they want them to go completely extinct or not, I think they just think the land exists for me. The land exists to raise elk. So that I can kill and eat elk. The land exists to be made completely cleansed of any sort of risk so that I can put livestock out for 8 months and not check on them. And I can, have a cow calf, somewhere unprotected and I don't have to check in on her. And I don't want, you know, vulnerable calves, around for wolves. And so that's this idea of convenience that everything exists for our needs. And I think that's the root of the problem. I think a lot has been made about the big bad wolf, myths. And that certainly has a role to play in why we think about, wolves as so scary, even though they don't pose very many risks. You know, as I mentioned, tigers sometimes kill people. Wolves don't kill people by and large. There's very, very few instances outside of rabid wolves that we have anything. You know, there's very few instances in modern history. But mountain lions and tigers and bears do kill people sometimes. So our perceptions of risk and what we're willing to accept is also kind of inconsistent and strange. And I'm not saying we should vilify predators that do attack people. I think we have plenty of opportunity to keep ourselves safe. But in terms of the risk that wolves pose to livestock, it's also very low. And yet we make a huge deal of it. So in the past 3 years, wolves have killed on average something like 0.004% of Idaho's cattle and sheep. And, you know, 40,000 cows each year in Idaho die from non-predator causes. That's weather, that's birthing complications, that's noxious weeds, that's all of these things that happen because cows are just put out on public lands or on vast landscapes and they're not attended to. And, you know, some of that's going to happen even if you have well-attended cows. And, you know, I should also mention that I come from three generations of farmers. I am completely sympathetic to the agricultural perspective. My grandfather raised dairy cows and then beef cows later on. So I understand how hard that work is, and I don't want to vilify anybody. But we have this modern system where we put cows out on public lands, and they're not attended to. And these public lands are also meeting the needs of outdoor recreationalists, meeting the needs of wildlife conservation, And so maybe we're asking too much of these multi-use landscapes, and we've got to figure out a better way to share in where these various uses occur. But again, I digress. So wolf hatred in Idaho, also I think is a function of a mistrust of the federal government. So wolves are seen, because they were listed as an endangered species and thus protected, on a federal level, they were seen as sort of, what's been called government dogs, or, just a way for the federal government to come in and tell people how, a landscape should be managed, whether it's public or private. People are worried that if there's an endangered species on my land or on the public lands that I use, my rights are being infringed upon. And that's an unfortunate, outcome of a long urban-rural divide that we've seen in North America and in the U.S. in particular. And so I think that explains a lot of the specific hatred that we see happening on a political landscape in places like Idaho, Montana, is that they've been, protected by the feds, and the feds are no good. They don't help us. So that's one of the other problems. And I'll stop there for at least a moment.
Thank you for all that. And I know that in Washington State, there's a program where if someone has a cow, again, I want to emphasize on public lands, and this cow is killed by a wolf, I believe they get twice market value. And if they think it was killed by a wolf, but they can't prove it, then I think they get full market value. Is there a similar payment program in Idaho?
That's a great question. And there's different payment programs, and I don't know offhand exactly how it works in Idaho. There's been a number of different compensation schemes in various different states for gray wolves and for Mexican gray wolves. And they vary by market value at the time of loss, market value at the time that you would be taking the cow to market in the fall. Those vary, and some of that funding has come and gone. So I'm not entirely sure specifically how it's happening in Idaho, but, I would just note that compensation, is sort of a band-aid, put after the fact. And we've done scientific studies. Many of my colleagues have looked into how compensation schemes work and whether or not they increase tolerance for wolves on the landscape. And we've really found that they don't help, in part because they're just seen as this band-aid. The conflict has already happened. The rancher loses time dealing with this loss. The rancher loses time having, a federal agent come and investigate whether or not it's a wolf. Oftentimes, these cows are found much later after the fact, so the carcasses are not in the best condition to investigate whether or not it was a wolf. And, wolves and coyotes and all kinds of other critters will come and scavenge a carcass afterwards. So to prove that it's a particular animal, you have to have bite marks, teeth marks at the length that would suggest a wolf and not a coyote or any other animal. And those bite marks would have to have hemorrhaging that shows that the animal was alive and that those bite marks caused bleeding while the animal was alive. Otherwise, it could be scavenged later on and you're not necessarily going to get the compensation. So often, people, again, because they vilify wolves, they assume, oh, this was a wolf kill, and it's not proven to be so, and so they don't get the compensation. Then they're frustrated with the program, they're frustrated with the lost time, they're frustrated with the lost cattle. So all of these things mean compensation programs really don't work. They're a band-aid, they're, just an after-the-fact kind of thought. Really, that money should be spent on preventing conflict before it happens. We can talk about all the different tools available to prevent any sort of depredation, even though it's rare in the first place. There's lots of tools available in particular contexts, and they vary by context, I should say. But, there's another program or another possible kind of program, which is to pay for presence of wolves. So that also incentivizes sharing the landscape and truly coexisting with with wildlife by paying ranchers for the number of wolves that exist in a place where they graze. And so that means everybody's incentivized to keep these animals alive on the ground and have as many as the habitat will sustain. And that money can be used to prevent any sort of livestock loss. So that's more of the win-win situation. And I really wish we were seeing more pay-for-presence programs rather than compensation.
You know, there's a great example of that working where I live. I live in Crescent City, California. And back in the 70s and 80s, I believe it was, the Aleutian geese had dropped to, I don't know, 600-700 geese, so to a very small number of geese. And when they would come through on their spring and fall migrations, they would, the entire world's population of Aleutian geese would land on, I think, five dairy farmer ranches, mm-hmm. and eat in their fields. And the, what the feds did is pay the ranchers for the hay that the geese would eat, and also let the ranchers, you know, put their cows somewhere else for a little while. And it was a tremendous success where they ended up with, went from like 600 up to, I don't know, 30,000 in several years. And it, I mean, from my understanding at that point, the ranchers didn't mind at all because, I mean, yeah, we can say that they're raising cattle, but really what they're doing is raising money. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it, anyway, so that's a great idea.
Yeah. Awesome.
I want to go a different direction for a second. And do you have, you said that there's like, is it 1,500 wolves in Idaho?
Yes, it's estimated. Yeah, the state agency estimates there's about 1,500 wolves in Idaho. And okay. The legislation is targeting 90% of those wolves.
What would you, even given the fact that Boise exists and that, you know, all these fairly big cities exist, and given the fact that the interstates exist and that there are cattle on the landscape and all that, what would you say, what would be your guess for a carrying capacity for Idaho for wolves?
Oh, that's a great question. And a really difficult one. I would have to have a lot more information at hand to be able to estimate carrying capacity for wolves in Idaho. And I don't have that at hand. But they have been pretty steady numbers across the Northern Rockies. You know, from 2011 to 2019, there's been estimated at least just under 5,000 wolves. Oh, no, that's have been killed. Sorry, I'm looking through my notes. But I would say that wolves, you know, they're seen as a symbol of wilderness, and they're thought to only be able to, exist in really wild, remote places. And that's not necessarily the case. So they're not great at living right next to people, in part because people often kill them if they're near people, and cars will kill them. And they do need, you know, significant prey to feed, you know, large, you know, packs of wolves. They're not as adaptable as coyotes who can switch to rodent prey, in places and live really close to people and even in cities. So they're not quite that adaptable, but they can live in lots of different habitats. So I would say there's room for more wolves across the Northern Rockies, despite the fact that places like Bozeman and Livingston and Boise, are growing, and threatening some of those corridors from, you know, the greater Yellowstone ecosystem into other, populations across Idaho and Montana. So there's definitely more room, and really the only threat to wolves, the only major threat are really, people, anthropogenic mortality, mostly from guns and traps and poisons, and then to a certain extent from cars.
And also, if we're going to have wolves expand their territory, then you would need a solid population there. So if you reduce the population, let's say the carrying capacity is 1,500, just to throw that out. Mm-hmm. And if you drop it to 150, then the wolves will simply be trying to refill that carrying capacity, as opposed to doing what they should be doing, which is expanding their range again, sending off young wolves to Oregon, California, Utah.
Washington. Yeah, exactly.
So do you want to talk about that at all, or do you want me to go to my next question?
Sure. I can expand a little bit on that. So yeah, the greater Yellowstone, ecosystem and in Idaho saw the reintroduction of wolves. And as they grew, they functioned as source populations, for the surrounding areas. So, if we eradicate wolves in Idaho, Montana, and, you know, I haven't mentioned Wyoming, and I know you want to focus on Idaho, but, you know, they're all kind of connected in some ways. You know, wolves and ecosystems don't necessarily recognize state borders. So, you know, those three states are an important source population for the surrounding areas. So as you mentioned, the states, like Washington and Oregon, we won't see recovery of those wolves if we're wiping out the source population. We're essentially making a source population into what they call a sink population, where there's too much mortality to really have a stable population. And really what's going to happen is that wolves, will not be able to eke out much of an existence. And, you know, wolves will be a species in Canada. And that's really scary to think of losing these populations. We hear stories of, you know, the first wolf coming back to California, or the first wolf in, you know, new counties in California, or the first wolf in the Grand Canyon. And what happens is, they get lost to anthropogenic mortality in the search for mates that aren't there. And that is just, it's a hopeless story if we're going to continue allowing these things to happen. And that's where, you know, another issue that comes up is the McKittrick policy that allows people to say, you know, I thought it was a coyote. I didn't know it was a wolf. And so hunters are not required to be responsible for knowing the animal that they're about to kill. The same thing has happened with grizzly bears. Oh, I thought it was a black bear, when it was actually an endangered grizzly bear. And then no one is held accountable for killing the only wolf in Grand Canyon. You know, the first one to return in decades. So it's really a problem. And wolves are only in 15% of their historic range, approximately 15%. And they should be in so much more. You know, there are major cities that they can't recolonize, but outside of major urban populations, if there is a good available prey base, there could be wolves, and there's just so much of that space, that wolves are not currently occupied, and it's not going to happen if we attack wolves, the way we see happening in Idaho.
And sorry if you don't want to go this direction, but also, first a question, then a comment. The question is, are white-tailed deer under their, are they one of their prey species?
Yes.
Okay, so here's the comment, which is there are places in the United States that, because of the eradication of predators, have way the hell too many white-tailed deer. And, and they're actually doing great harm to forests because they browse the there is not enough, what's the word, what's the conservation biology word, replacement or, the word for when you have a baby cottonwood tree or a baby.
Recruitment.
Thank you. Anyway, so I have a friend who lives in Binghamton, New York, who there, the university there has a test forest, and the reserve is overrun with deer. And this guy absolutely loves ground dwelling birds. Actually, his wife loves ground dwelling birds, and he loves amphibians. And both the amphibians and the ground dwelling birds are getting absolutely hammered by white-tailed deer eating all the ground cover. And he would be over the moon if wolves came back in. So my point is just to reinforce that there is plenty of prey base in lots of places that have a lot of deer who would make very nice meals for wolves.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, if we're talking about Idaho, elk are super important, prey item for wolves, and elk are doing great in Idaho. You know, 7 years in a row, the Idaho Fish and Game has reported that, hunters are taking, upwards of 20,000 elk per year. So, elk are not, you know, in any danger of being over-harvested by wolves by any means. Again, I don't know elk populations all that well, but and I don't know if the hunting pressure from humans is too much, but I know that there's plenty of elk available for wolves if we were willing to share.
So before we go, I want to ask you about the Endangered Species Act in a minute, but before we go there, I know this is a kind of old story, but can you talk about the miracles that happen when predators are reintroduced to a landscape and how, for example, reintroducing wolves can help trout, which, you know, doesn't seem like it would, that seems like a bit of a leap, but it's very true.
Absolutely. It's a beautiful story. It's a somewhat complex story, that sometimes tries to get simplified. But really we're seeing in lots of places when we have the return of an apex predator like wolves, in Yellowstone in particular, this has been studied, for a couple decades now. We see that, wolves predating on elk change their behavior. So they're not hanging out and over browsing the vegetation near rivers. That allows the vegetation to regrow. That allows songbirds to nest in that vegetation. That allows less erosion problems along those rivers. So they meander more. This is the sort of famous, video I'm referencing of a YouTube video basically that got really popular about how wolves change rivers. And it's been attacked as being an oversimplification of the story. And that story is trophic cascades and what I'm just explaining about of wolves and all of the sort of domino positive effect of having an apex predator on the landscape and returning these systems as they used to function and as should be functioning. And we don't always see that happening, but there's a lot of reasons why we might not see trophic cascades happening. In particular, if we are exploiting wolf populations and not allowing them to reach carrying capacity and not allowing them to exist at a level where they are really fulfilling their ecological goal, their ecological functions, then we might not see trophic cascades. Sorry. But if we have unexploited predator populations in these wild landscapes, we see a huge increase in biodiversity. We see much healthier watersheds. We see much healthier populations of all kinds of species, from songbird to songbird biodiversity to beavers returning. You know, it's a very complex web and everything is connected. And apex predators are really a sort of keystone species, and it's called a keystone species because it's that sort of very important cornerstone that holds the whole thing together. And of course, prey are important. Of course, the plants that are photosynthesizing in that landscape are important, and they all play a role. But apex predators can have an outsized effect in promoting ecosystem health and function.
And this is just true everywhere. That I read a story a few months ago about how there was a marsh that they were attempting to help restore in, oh gosh, I think it was mainland Europe, like Holland or somewhere, I don't remember where. And the reeds kept closing in the marsh and filling it in again until some geese happened to stop by, and wild geese, migratory geese, and the geese rediscovered the marsh, and through their predation, if you were, on the reeds, they kept it from, I think the word is eutrophying, and it was the same deal, that in this case it was geese who drove the recovery of the entire marsh community. And it's just, I keep thinking about this line by David Ehrenfeld, that nature is not only more complex than we think, it's more complex than we can think.
I love that. That's totally accurate.
So before we started recording, you had said that if I brought up the Endangered Species Act and wolves, that you might ramble. So could you please ramble a little bit on the ESA and wolves?
Sure. So the Endangered Species Act has been just a landmark piece of legislation that has had such incredible success rates in protecting the species that have been listed. But the blowback has been significant, and it's eroded the ability of the ESA to function properly. And one of the most important aspects of the Endangered Species Act is that decisions should be made based on sound science, the best available science that we have. We've seen, again, referencing the sort of urban-rural divide, the mistrust of the federal government by certain stakeholders. We've seen attacks on the ESA as a way to also wage a war on wolves. And so, one of the worst attacks on the ESA was to legislation to delist wolves, so to remove their ESA listing through legislation instead of through a decision through the Fish and Wildlife Service. And this was in 2011. It was a bargaining chip for Senator Tester in Montana to win his reelection bid and fight off the challenge of an anti-wolf opponent that was running against him. And so the legislation removed federal protections through the ESA for wolves in the Northern Rockies. And it also forbid judicial review, meaning, you couldn't sue and have a court review this decision. So basically Congress decided wolves shouldn't be listed anymore. And they decided that through an appropriation in a federal budget bill that had to pass. It was such a sneaky move, and it had nothing to do with science. It had nothing to do with the recovery of wolves and that they were still recovering. And it stopped science from being able to inform a decision about how we manage wolves. And now today, this happened in 2011. Now today in 2021, we see, more attacks from politicians to eradicate wolves more, even though nothing in science says that wolves are recovered. Another aspect of the ESA that's really important is that it calls for recovery of an endangered species in a significant portion of its historic range. And as I mentioned earlier, wolves are in not more than 15% of their historic range. So I'm not a math whiz. It's been a long time since I've taken calculus, but I don't know how you can interpret 15% to be a significant portion of anyone's historic range. If you only had 15% of your house available for you, I think you would say that's not significant enough. I need more of my house available to me. I can't have just a corner of the kitchen. I also need a bedroom and a bathroom and a living room, right? So to say that wolves are recovered is laughable if it wasn't so sad, really.
So you mentioned this a couple times, the 15% of range. Can you give the current United States range for continental United States range for wolves and tell us the historic range? I'm sorry, specifically for gray wolves. We're not talking about Mexican gray wolves. We're not talking about red wolves. And are there other species of wolves in the United States besides red and Mexican gray? I guess those are subspecies. Okay, two questions. First off, what are the subspecies of wolves in the United States? Second question, what is the historic range and current range?
Okay, so to your first question, Mexican gray wolves are the only subspecies of gray wolves. The rest of the U.S. is gray wolves, other than in the Southeast, which is red wolves. And they're considered a separate species.
Very many.
Right. And there's hardly any. That's another failure of the Fish and Wildlife Service to recover red wolves, which really could have been done by banning coyote night hunting and a number of other things that we don't necessarily need to get into. But again, it wouldn't be rocket science if we had leadership to really recover these species that are politically contentious. We wouldn't see these low numbers like we do of lobos, Mexican gray wolves, or of red wolves. And now for gray wolves, basically all of them. The other complicating factor that we don't necessarily need to get into a whole lot is that there's a lot of hybridization. So red wolves have a good amount of coyote. Eastern gray wolves have some coyote genes. Great Lakes wolves have maybe a little bit in some places. And so it's, you know, some biologists call it Canis supus, basically, instead of Campbell's soup. It's a real mix of canid genes because they can hybridize. And, you know, there are also domestic dog genes. For instance, the black wolf coat might actually be from integration of dog genes into wolves. But so that's a whole nother topic. That's really fascinating how complex it can get. But that's basically it. There are gray wolves, and there are a subspecies of Mexican gray wolves in the Southwest, and then there's a separate species of red wolves in the Southeast. Until they do more research and somebody else makes an argument that red wolves are a subspecies or something, which, you know, science gets new information and things can change. So our understanding of canid genetics might change the way we define species. And really the notion of species and the definition that they can't breed with a different species is kind of a simplistic way to think about it. And canids show us how complex that family tree can be.
That can be really the belief that if they can interbreed, that makes them, that they're still the same species. It's really harmful to, wildlife conservation because spotted owls, one of the threats to them is invasive barred owls with whom they interbreed.
Mm-hmm.
But they're still not spotted owls. So the babies are hybrid, spotted and barred owls.
Right. And then how do you manage those hybrids? And it's the same thing with, you know, with wolves. Do we consider an endangered species and do we manage it so? Or do we say we don't want the hybrids? We want to maintain these distinct species. You know, that's one question. But we also have to think about the reality of the world and that, you know, evolution is not a static thing. So for humans to intervene and try and keep things separate is really maybe kind of an outdated idea. And, you know, if coyote genes help an animal be really adaptable and perhaps a little more behaviorally plastic, perhaps able to hunt smaller prey and maybe live in packs or maybe live more solitary lives, you know, that's not necessarily a bad thing. So, I would argue for really kind of rethinking these notions about how we define species and whether we would kill a hybrid or, you know, a more common species that's successful and contributing to ecosystems, contributing to biodiversity, fulfilling their niches. You know, there's so many values for these animals, and it's a really complex question to consider when you're trying to save an endangered species.
I hear you, and I agree that the solution to barred owls and spotted owls is not to shoot the barred owls, which is what they do.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the solution in that particular case is to stop cutting old growth, which the spotted owls favor.
Absolutely.
I think if you stop cutting the old growth, barred owls don't come in quite so much, and it's not actually a problem.
Absolutely. You hit the nail on the head. And, you know, I did a study where I surveyed a random 1,000 Americans and posed these sort of case studies to them. I posed the barred owl versus spotted owl question. I posed caribou and wolves. I posed a question on sea lions and salmon. I mean, the examples go on and on of how we scapegoat one species that predates on somebody else or outcompetes another species when the root issue is really habitat. It's about habitat fragmentation and habitat loss. And all of those threats are what needs to be addressed to really, you know, conserve habitat and save these species.
So back to range. What was the range of non-Mexican and non-red wolves in continental United States?
So basically across the continental United States, Canada and Alaska. I mean, gray wolves are, you know, one of the farthest ranging, species, basically in the Northern Hemisphere. So they're really wide ranging. So they were found in all of the lower 48, other than, you know, the Southwest states that have the subspecies of Mexican gray wolves. And, there's a lot of debate on what the historical record says, on what the range was for Mexican gray wolves. And there probably was some overlap in places like Utah and Colorado. But Mexican gray wolves were definitely, well, I shouldn't even say definitely, but they were likely, mostly in Arizona, New Mexico, and then Mexico. I'm not sure whether their range is debated to have gone into California or not. But yeah, so other than the Southeast and the Southwest, gray wolves were found everywhere else. And so that 15%, we're talking about gray wolves across, across their historic range in the lower 48.
So what this means also is that they were adaptable to a multitude of biomes. They could be in forest, they could be in grassland, they could be in swamp. Is this true?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And there's some research to suggest that the habitat that you grew up in, like many of us, you know, we have an affinity towards that same habitat that you grew up in. So there could be culture, there could be a personal tendency to stay in a habitat that you're most familiar with, that you grew up in, you know, that you were raised in, and your parents, you know, knew the prey species there, so passed on that knowledge to you. We see culture happening, certain packs in Yellowstone. There's only one that can hunt bison. The rest focus on elk. Or other species. So we see that they have potentially an affinity for certain individuals will have an affinity for certain habitats. But really, wolves are not specialists. They're generalists. They don't need pure wilderness. They can live in lots of different habitats and are really adaptable. In the Great Lakes, for instance, beavers are a huge part of their diet. So we see a lot of variability in the behavior and habitat preferences of wolves.
So I'm going to ask a really silly question, and then I'm going to ask a wind-down question.
Okay.
The silly question is, do they ever eat fish? How about salmon? How about in a salmon area, if there's dead salmon on the stream, would they scavenge them?
Yes. Yeah, and we see that a lot. There's a pretty famous wolf population in I think it's British Columbia or – yeah, I think it's British Columbia, and there might also be populations in Alaska, too, that are known for their fishing ability.
Hmm. Oh, that's right. I think I saw a video about them. They call them sea wolves, I think.
Yes, exactly. And they're gorgeous. Their coat has a little bit of red. They're really, really very gorgeous animals. And they're also, sadly, under threat from hunters.
So, okay, another silly question. Do those sea wolves, do they eat seals then, too, like if they're on shore?
I'm not sure. I wouldn't put it past them. You know, the predators are opportunistic, and if there's a meal available, I don't think they're usually too picky.
Okay, so we have like 5 minutes left, and can you talk about two things that are just happening? One of them is you talked about a billboard before we started, and also you talked about a campaign having to do with Idaho.
Okay, yes. So we have a billboard going up outside of Cody, well, outside of Yellowstone National Park in Cody, Wyoming, and that's drawing attention to wolves that may be targeted in wildlife killing contests in the state. So another campaign that Project Coyote works on is to stop wildlife killing contests where they occur. We've banned it in 7 states and hopefully 8 in Maryland very soon. And we're looking to stop it on a national level. And now that wolves are delisted and very vulnerable in states like Wyoming, Idaho, and Montana, they could be targeted in these killing contests where people compete for cash and prizes. Sometimes those prizes are guns to kill the most animals, sometimes the largest. Sometimes you can get a prize for the smallest animal. And they often target coyotes. But they can also target other predators like wolves and mountain lions. So we're trying to draw attention to the fact that that's happening. And, you know, there's a lot of people coming from all over to visit Yellowstone National Park you know, one of America's greatest ideas is epitomized in Yellowstone National Park. It's a beautiful place, but it is a proverbial zoo where animals can be hunted and killed as soon as they leave park boundaries. And we see that happen with wolves. We see that happen with bison. And, you know, it's a travesty, really, that these animals can exist in one place and step outside of an invisible line and get completely obliterated. So we want to draw attention to that. We have a billboard to let people know that these beautiful wolves that you see in the park are not safe as soon as they step outside the park, and that a place that you're giving money, like Wyoming and also Idaho, this applies, the money that you're giving to go there shouldn't happen if the state continues to allow it. So we're hoping people see that and say, you know what, I'm not going to visit a place. I'm not going to give my dollars to a place that allows these terrible things to happen. And so the other thing that we're doing is we've got a petition, dedicated to Secretary Interior, Deb Haaland, and the Fish and Wildlife Service, going to Martha Williams, the Deputy Director of the Fish and Wildlife Service, asking them to please listen to the scientist sign-on letter that I and many of Project Coyote's Science Advisory Board members signed. A total of 115 scientists signed this letter saying, you know, protect the ESA, protect wolves, make decisions about wolves based on science, and the science says they're not recovered. So we've sent that letter, and now we have a petition where people can say, please, Deb Haaland, please, Martha Williams, listen to the scientists that are saying wolves are not recovered and intervene and relist wolves. So we've got that petition. We've got the billboard. We're also doing work, a ton of work every day in Wisconsin to help protect wolves and stop coyote killing contests there, or wildlife killing contests. So a ton of work. So I would just ask people to check out projectcoyote.org and see everything that we're doing, sign the petition, share it with your friends, tell people about what's happening so that we can expose this, so that we can tell Idaho and Montana and Wyoming and Wisconsin that the world is watching. They want wolves, and they are not going to visit if these sort of tragic war on wolves continues.
That's all really great. Thank you for that. Is there anything else you want to say before we sign off?
I guess I would say, you know, part of the problem, one thing that I haven't said yet is that states currently can't be trusted to manage wolves because of the level of politics that occurs there, and because science isn't being considered. So America's wildlife management on the state level is a failed state, really. You know, a failed state is a body, a political body that's disintegrated to the point where it's not meeting its responsibilities as a government. It's not functioning properly. And state wildlife agencies, particularly in the Northern Rockies, are failing. They have a long history of failure, and they do not meet the basic public trust responsibilities to conserve wildlife. That's why we keep returning to this. That's why conservationists keep saying wolves have to be federally protected, because states are not going to do their job.
Well, thank you so much for all that, and thank you for your work in the world. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Michelle Lute. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.
Thanks so much.
You're fabulous. That was so good.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, that was really great.
I'm glad that it felt like it went well, and I didn't ramble too much.
No, it's great. This is absolutely fabulous. Is there any other subject you'd want to do an interview on again at some time in the future? I mean, you're just so articulate on this. Are there other issues you work on that you want to talk about?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we could talk about wildlife killing contests. We could talk about wildlife governance reform, which is sort of the last point that I made about state agencies. You know, there's so much that we can be doing to be reforming things on the state level. And there's lots of potential actions for your listeners to think about in terms of what they can do in their own home state. That would be huge for not just wolves if they have them, but all kinds of wildlife. It would change really, you know, wildlife conservation on a fundamental level. So wildlife killing contest is one, wildlife governance reform on a state level across the country is another. I'm sure there's more, you know, all kinds of stuff on coexisting with coyotes.
Okay. Well, let's do that. Why don't, if you don't mind, Send me a note with those topics and we'll start setting it up.
Excellent. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thanks. I'm going to go because there are literally, bears down on my porch that I need to go say hi to.
Okay. Awesome.
Yeah, it's a mother and two babies. They're very friendly. Anyway, so I'm stopping.